Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
All right. Welcome to On the Wing podcast, fueled by Purina Pro Plan, coming at you for Rooster Road Trip episode 2. Thank you for joining us to ride shotgun on our annual trip across public lands in search of wild birds. And our boots have been laced up for a few hours. We're taking a midday break as the temperatures rise, and I'll set the scene a little bit. We are in a city. I have a hard time calling this a city. A town park? What would you call this, Jesse?
Yeah, town park.
Town park.
City of Glen Ullin Park.
Glen Ullin, North Dakota. A park on Monday. We just finished lunch, and we're all by ourselves. I think I'm going to go down the slide after we're done with the podcast.
The little kid one or like the big kid one?
Well, look at me. So I'm going to make the joke myself, I think.
You finished it.
So joining us for a Rooster Road Trip in a county park in North Dakota, thanks to our Rooster Road Trip partners, Browning Firearms, Federal Ammunition, Orvis Hunting Apparel and Dog Products, Rufflin Kennels, Garmin, Irish Setter Boots, Sound Gear Hearing Protection, and Yeti Coolers. 8 corporate partners riding shotgun, generating revenue for our wildlife habitat mission. Thank you to each and every one of them. As I mentioned, we are somewhere between Bismarck and Dickinson. Glen Ullin is where we've had lunch, but we didn't really hunt that close to here, did we? You know, maybe 20 miles.
There's a lot of ground out in this country. People have to try really hard to figure out where we were.
And the voice you hear back, per usual, quarterback of the Rooster Road Trip, the vice president of marketing for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, Andrew Vavra. Also joining us again for episode 2, the state coordinator for North Dakota, Emily Spolier. A little bit earlier in the day today.
Yeah, last night you kept me up way past my bedtime. I could barely string my thoughts together by the time we stopped recording.
It was past my bedtime, too. And our new addition, your title is Upland Game Biologist?
Yeah, I'm an Upland Game Biologist for the North Dakota Game and Fish Department.
Jesse Kohler, the North Dakota Game and Fish Department's Upland Game Biologist. So we've got obviously an ace up our sleeve today, helping put us on birds as we chase public land, roosters, sharpies, huns, although it's been pretty much focused on pheasants so far on this trip. Today we're going to talk a little bit about what we've been doing so far this morning, but with Jesse's addition, we've got a unique opportunity to pick the brain of the state's upland biologist, but you know a little something beyond upland birds. Let's start just kind of an introduction about who you are and where you're from and a little bit of background for us.
Yeah, so first of all, probably not the ace up the sleeve you were hoping for. Most of my job is counting birds during the summer and spring, so seasons where they're not exactly where they are during hunting season. Hence why it was a little tough this morning finding spots. I'm not too familiar with this area this time of year. But yeah, I am familiar with the geography. I was from Dickinson.
You were born in Dickinson.
Okay. And graduated from high school there. Went to Montana for college and studied wildlife biology.
Which Montana State? Or
the only, yeah.
Montana. The only.
No, not state. University
of Montana.
The Montana, yep. Went to Missoula for 4 years and came back. I was working. My dad's an electrician, so I did wiring to pay off all my student loans. That paid better than being a wildlife technician. And while I was doing that, there was an opening with the Game and Fish Department to fly around in a plane and track pronghorn antelope for some people that, yeah, they were radio collared and they're trying to figure out if they were moving between when they surveyed them in July and then our fall hunting season. So we, in the state, we have a gratis hunting license. Landowners can get a free license, but they have to hunt on their land. Huh. And so we had a lot of issues from people who said, you know, I put up with pronghorn on my land all year round, but then during hunting season, they're not there. So they collared, you know, 60 in the beginning. I think we collared over 100 during the study. But originally just looking at that question, and then after I was there for a couple of years, I turned that into my master's degree or my thesis work for my master's.
So let me make sure I understand that. So you landowners in North Dakota get a free hunting license for pronghorn because of crop degradation.
Yep. Yep.
But when hunting season rolls around, the pronghorn are no longer on those private landowners' agricultural fields.
That was the argument. Yeah.
The argument. Okay. Yep, that's and what'd you learn?
And just to clarify, they do have to apply for that. So it's not, they don't all get the free license. It depends on our surveys, how many licenses are available, and they get a certain proportion that they can apply for. What we learned was that they weren't moving hardly at all between July and October. They were often within the same square mile that they were in July. But they do bunch up a lot. So, you know, they could have been spread out, including some of them that were on lands in the summer that weren't there in October.
Hmm. How many pronghorn did you see today on our drive?
There's a herd of 18 right after we left that first spot.
So I've only spent like a couple hours with you, but you can identify numbers like instantly.
Yeah, that's what we do for our, that's most of my work is counting flocks and counting herds. So.
When earlier in the day, when sharptails got up really wild, in about 2 seconds, Jesse looks at me and is like, oh, 18.
I guess 20, so that makes me feel good. Yeah, all right.
Yeah. He's like a wildlife counting savant.
No, that's just a habit we get in. And we just finished mule deer surveys right now, so our department's really small. So even though I'm an upland biologist, I help out doing deer surveys. We don't have very many people who don't get sick in the airplane flying over the Badlands, so I jumped in and yes, I've been counting all week. So
what are
stuck
those,
in that mode.
Resume bullets you didn't think you would need. Huh?
Yeah.
Doesn't get sick in helicopters.
Yeah. That was actually
hired.
That was my job interview for that pronghorn job. I showed up and he goes, "Can you show up Monday?" And I showed up. He drove me to the airport. We met the pilot there. Seat buckled in. Got buckled in the back seat and went up flying for a half hour. And I didn't know what we were doing. I said, "Well, this was pretty fun." He said, "Do you want to count those?" And he had me count a few herds of pronghorn and circled them and flew back to the airport. And I was like, "So what was that all about?" And he's like, "Well, do you feel sick?" And I was like, "No." And he's like, "You got the job." So that was the easiest interview I ever had for, because I don't get sick, I guess. If I get sick, that would have been the most miserable interview. But.
Two things going for you. You can count up to 20, yeah. And you don't get sick.
Yeah, pretty slip by.
You know, as you and Andrew had conversations leading up to this, and I know sage grouse was part of that. Tell me about kind of the status of sage grouse in North Dakota.
Yeah, so years later, I ended up as a biologist in Montana, in Jordan, Montana. And part of my job there was working with sage grouse. And, you know, Jordan's a lot closer to the center of sage grouse range, so the habitat looked really good. And they were seeing declines in certain dancing grounds for sage grouse around Jordan. When I came back and took this position in North Dakota in 2017, we had a project going on to translocate sage grouse back to North Dakota
from
Wyoming.
From Wyoming.
Yep. And fresh out of, you know, the heart of some good sage grouse country in Montana, I just remember thinking, why are we doing this? It's, you know, it's not good habitat left in North Dakota. You drive down there and you know, a lot of agricultural development, a lot of oil and gas development, even just houses, roads, way station right near one of the old dancing grounds. A lot of things going on that fragmented and broke up their good habitat. They're really picky birds. So having seen areas that look pristine in Montana have, you know, very small development and start affecting the dancing ground, I I guess I didn't expect ours should have been doing any better. However, looking at all that, we had most of our development occurred in the 1980s in North Dakota, and our sage-grouse population hung on through the early 2000s until West Nile virus hit the ground. So when that finally had warm enough winters a few years in a row where West Nile moved up, or I should say summers, I guess the mosquito was moving north as the summers got warmer. But as those years came and West Nile hit, I think it was just the nail in the coffin for our sage grouse. They declined pretty precipitously, and you know, we haven't seen a really good boom year in their numbers since 2000. Yeah, probably two or three was the last really good year for sage grouse in North Dakota.
So I think to give people an idea of when you talk about the numbers of sage grouse in North Dakota, you're not talking about thousands of birds or hundreds of birds.
Yep. It was probably in the thousands historically. So when the Gibbon fish started counting, we were at, you know, maybe 500 total population. We're just counting the males. So, you know, a couple hundred males total we were counting. So there's probably a population of 500 to 750 in the fall. Currently we're in the handfuls. So I think last year we counted 10 males total.
Wow.
10 or 11, I'd have to double check, but regardless, it's just peanuts of a population. Mm-hmm. And we never were the center. We've always been on the edge. They've never, you know, it's pretty much Bowman County, Slope County, and Golden Valley counties, the far southwestern corner of the state. But it's, you know, when they're disappearing from the edge of the state, I guess it's kind of a warning to places further toward the core that, you know, it's your core is becoming the edge now. So it's alarming. And you know, south of Baker, Montana used to be an easy place to drive the road and see sage grouse in the spring. And, you know, it's getting harder down there now as well. South Dakota's closed their sage grouse hunting season after we did. It's not good news for sage grouse.
Do you remember them as a kid? Give us a ballpark of your age and what you grew up in the 80s or 90s?
I grew up in the 80s, yep. And the first time I saw a sage grouse was until I was probably in my 20s.
Oh, okay.
For sure. And in college, actually probably when I was working on that pronghorn project, that's also a very important wintering area for pronghorn. So sage grouse habitat is, you know, pretty poor farming land, pretty poor range land. It's usually most landowners call it rank sagebrush because it's not very good
rank sagebrush.
You know, it's not great for a lot of other uses, but it is good for a lot of wildlife winter cover and food. So pronghorn is one of the species that also uses that, and ended up down there a lot while we had pronghorn collared. I'd track them down there, and then just remember the first time I flushed a sage grouse, saw something the size of a turkey get up and didn't know what it was, and instantly knew, you know, not a sharp tail or not a pheasant. It's way bigger. So, so that was the first time, and told people quite often that that spring I told my dad we should go out after I'd seen flushed them quite a few times down there. I said, we should go down and see them dancing. You know, they dance like a sharp tail, but it's a different dance. And so we went down and, you know, no effort, no maps. We just went down and took a drive and, you know, looked around a few spots. And sure as heck, we found, you know, first or second spot we stopped, we were able to glass and pick out a leck of sage grouse dancing. If you would do that today, you wouldn't, you know, even me knowing where they're at, I can't find them a lot of mornings to take people down and show you sage grouse in North Dakota. So yeah, it's, you know, like I said, since 2000 to now, we've pretty much lost all that we had.
Is there any hope of turning things around in North Dakota, or is that a lost cause?
I'd say it's a lost cause, other than the fact that we do still have some remaining habitat. You never know, but sagebrush is a very slow-growing habitat. I think, you know, even if we could have complete control over all the land in southwestern North Dakota to reclaim everything, it would take 20 to 30 years to get it back to where it was and to where we had enough habitat to where we could draw birds from South Dakota or Montana or translocate more back up here.
So folks listening, you know, they're thinking, well, I want to go to North Dakota, pheasant hunting, sharpie hunting, chase some huns around, and they're listening to get intel. Now they're hearing about sage grouse, and there's a little bit of trepidation, like, gosh, I hope I don't shoot one of those, the odds of somebody out here pheasant hunting seeing a sage grouse where you would be pheasant hunting are almost nil, right?
Unless you were Bowman County, Western Bowman County is pretty much the only place you'd still see sage grouse. Maybe Western Golden Valley and Slope. You know, we still have dancing grounds just across the border into Montana, so they can range into there. But yeah, it'd be pretty slim odds. And I guess if you were pheasant hunting and you're used to pausing to see if it's a rooster or a hen, I think you'd definitely know that it wasn't a rooster right away. They're quite a bit different, quite mm-hmm. a bit blacker, and yeah, you'd recognize you'd have something to be, was off. But
you'd have to make a really big mistake think that was a rooster.
Yeah. Although a young sage grouse, if you were sharp tail hunting, you know, and a young sage grouse got up, especially a hen, I could see somebody mistaking that. But yeah, it'd be pretty rare. I mean, there just aren't enough left to where that'd be common in most of the state, unless you're hunting on the far southwestern edge of the state.
So I want to transition a little bit to the state of North Dakota for pheasants and sharpies hunts. Before I do, I want to just give a shout out to Purina, national sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and the presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast. My pups, Esky, Gitchy, and Winter all eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina sports the wildlife habitat conservation mission of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And that's extremely important to me, and it should be extremely important to you, the listener. But the most important thing is that Purina Pro Plan has the world's best team of scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. In fact, Purina Pro Plan Sport, that purple bag or the text, the black bag with purple text featuring a image of a German Shorthair on the bag, was created specifically to fuel hardworking bird dogs like yours and like mine. For increased endurance, joint support, and muscle tone, it all starts with Purina Pro Plan Sport. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com. Purina Pro Plan, nutrition that performs. All right, I teased as we went into that Purina Pro Plan spot, kind of wanted to get a state of the state from you. You know, what's this is probably what, week three for the pheasant season, and a bit longer, about 6 weeks in, maybe 7 weeks in for sharpies and huns. Give us the forecast for North Dakota. How's the cover? What was the weather like? What are your bird numbers like?
Well, given our recent trends, I guess I'd say people should be coming up here. It's good right now. The pheasant numbers especially have been good. We've lost a lot of grass in the state, so it's not going to be back to 2007. The numbers people remember when we last peaked. A lot of people, locals especially, have those expectations that it's going to get back to that number, and so they think right now it's really poor. The truth is it's probably not going to get back there, and I think right now, given the habitat, we're in as good as it's going to be until we see some huge scale programs for grass back on the landscape. So right now it's pretty good.
I think about 07, North Dakota had, if my memory is right, 3 million acres CRP in 07. Where is it at today?
Yeah, we're just below a million. So we've lost over 2 million acres of nesting habitat. And not just 2 million acres, but when you think about how that was spaced out, our CRP was, some areas it was big tract, but in a lot of places it was small tracts of grass. So just, you know, across the state, that was a really good smattering of habitats.
Mm. So when you say, like, the grass is not coming back, as someone who has been intimately involved in watching, you know, the sage grouse kind of decline and just kind of blink off the map in certain spots, are you worried about other species, sharpies, what have you, in terms of is this like a slippery slope that we might witness in other regards, or is there hope for the future? Or am I reading too much into that comment? So I guess working for a conservation organization, just to hear that grass ain't coming back, that's terrifying to me, because like that's what we're trying to put more of on the landscape. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, it's absolutely hard not to be cynical. I don't want to be completely negative. I think it is important that people see the red flag, and that we, you know, if we don't do anything, that we are going to lose a lot more than what we've already lost. I don't think you can find a place in the U.S. where we have gone backwards after, you know, once you get to 75% of the grass gone, you don't see places where all of a sudden it goes back to where it's in grass. And not just in the U.S., no place in the world has seen that. Once stuff gets developed, it's usually developed. So if people really want that to come back, it's going to have to be a big concerted effort. But I do want to leave some hope. I guess a few things that I've seen that are inspiring. Some of the new agricultural practices, you know, with the ability to leave poorer soils, you know, the precision ag, there's definitely room there to where people could start leaving more habitat. Regenerative ag is a big buzzword. I think there's a lot of really good that comes out of regenerative ag, with keeping more cattle mixed in their farming operations, so they'll always have some grass for that. And then I think, you know, people are realizing the decline of grasslands across the nation. So I think there's constantly bills that get introduced into legislation and parts of the farm bill that get proposed, maybe not to keep CRP, but maybe it's a new program similar to CRP, but getting a little bit more flexibility than what CRP had. I think the downfall of CRP was that it really had firm sidewalls that trapped landowners, you know, not at the beginning of their contracts. It might have been a great deal, but years down the road when they're close to getting out of that contract and they looked at what they got paid per acre, those prices have gone up. They've skyrocketed since a lot of those contracts were started. So the backside of CRP, it was really hard to stomach for people. So maybe a new program that's got some of the same longevity as CRP and some commitments that require people to enroll for long term, but also have some options of ways to get out or swap lands or manage their CRP. Even just, you know, a lot of the stuff, the first place we walked today was I'm not positive that was CRP, but it looked like CRP, and it was getting to be, even for habitat, it was like it could use something to get some of those introduced cool season grasses like the smooth brome, which had taken over, get that out of there and get to some better grass mixes.
Sounds like we need a North American grasslands.
It's hard not to think about that.
Yeah, for sure. But like for those of you at home, get your butts up to North Dakota. The bird numbers are great by everyone's, you know, anecdotal observations and people putting boots down. But don't get complacent.
Yeah.
Just because you have one great year and people are saying, come check this out, doesn't mean that the work is done and it will always be like this. Like you always have to be vigilant and understand, like, you always have to be working at this because there are factors working against this, whether you're conscious to it or not.
So I think about, as you're talking about the price of CRP that landowners made when they signed a 10 or 15 year contract at the beginning of the contract. Well, they signed thinking, well, this is reasonable at that time, but things have changed over time. We talk at great length in our organization about soil rental rates need to keep pace for CRP with what the landowner would get for cash crop rent. Yep. And I think about the very first time I came to North Dakota on a hunt. I was with a coworker of mine who's now retired, Rick Young, brought me up to the McCluskey area. And I remember hunting sharptails for the first time in my life, and we were hunting around this field that he called Flax. And I was like, I've never heard of flax before. And then we were hunting next to sunflowers. And I'm like, I've never seen a field of sunflowers. You know, 20 years ago, corn and beans in North Dakota was something that existed south of I-94, which basically is kind of the southern one-third of North Dakota. Everything north of that was sunflowers and flax and canola and wheat. And as time has gone by, and you know, we're south of 94 today, but we were hunting north of 94 yesterday, and there's corn everywhere. And the price of corn versus the price of flax is part of what you're talking about influencing the rental rates on those properties, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the north-south divide is significant, but east-west is the other one with the
Missouri River.
The rain shadow from the Rocky Mountains goes to about the Missouri River. So, You know, I grew up in Dickinson and never saw soybeans until, probably until the last 10, 15 years is when they really started showing up. Didn't even know what it was. I saw that first fuzzy leaf coming out of the ground. So that's all changed. And then there are some things that just tip the scales. You know, all the culture around here is still that everything west of Mandan is the gateway to the west and cowboy country, and there's a lot of that imagery, but the truth is that a lot of that's been dead for a long time. Even west of Dickinson is getting to be where it's more farming and John Deere country than cowboy country anymore.
Huh.
And so that kind of imagery changed somewhat with improved crop varieties, somewhat with our weather and climate trends, maybe getting a longer growing season. But probably primarily just with Farm Bill, basically your ability to guarantee getting some income despite what comes out of the ground. So some of those poorer grounds probably should have never been broken up. And that's the unfortunate thing that I think even the landowners don't want to do that. It's stupid not to do it if you can make that much money, but a lot of them know better and don't want to do that. So if there were, like I said, if there were a more flexible program, I think there are certain cohort of people that would be interested, and I think it'd be a good mix, not just for conservation, but for landowners as well.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna ask Jesse, another prairie grouse species in North Dakota that people might not realize we have any here is prairie chickens, and I know that there are species that has, especially, you know, on that eastern North Dakota border, been impacted by development. Can you talk a little bit about our prairie chickens and kind of what their population is at now and maybe how that's changed in the last 10, 15 years?
Yeah, absolutely. Another depressing one to start out with. So we'll end with more of the good news with partridge and pheasant and sharptail. But likewise, their numbers are dismal. Grand Forks County had a translocation project during the 90s where we brought birds in from South Dakota, Nebraska, and Minnesota, got the local population there up into the, 500 males, so probably, 1,000 to 1,500 total birds in the fall. We were able to have hunting season, really successful, and that was all because we had, a few permanent land secured, the Kelly's Slough, which is a federal wildlife refuge. We had Ed Bry and Greater Prairie Chicken Wildlife Management Areas were secured, and then Oakville Prairie, which was secured for the university. All of those gave enough acreage to where the biologists at the time thought we'd be able to introduce chickens, and there'd be enough habitat to where they'd withstand the, the winters and be able to get by. They did really well. I don't know. We did have a lot of CRP in the county at that time, so in Grand Forks County. So I think that was what probably helped them the most. And that's what we've lost since then. Not just lost, but the quality of what was there has been converted. A lot of it, slowly over time. We've had wet years that it switches to cattails really quickly from grass to cattails. We've also, as that area gets more populated, there's no ability to burn, and fire is kind of a bad word in North Dakota. So Siberian elm and Russian olive trees will both fill in those grassland areas. Good part is that it's turned into a really good sharp-tailed grouse area. They're a lot more flexible, but the bad part was that the prairie chickens pretty much have disappeared from there. There are a handful, I think total was 5 or 6 males counted this spring, with the possibility, with that few birds, they're not very faithful to their dancing ground. So it's possible that we even double counted some of those. So there might have been fewer than 5 males that we know of in the whole county. So as a population, it's by all means, it's practically extirpated from there. So, and again, we have the one hope for there is we still have some travel and connection with Minnesota's population, so they could always resource that area if the habitat would come back or were to be reinvested in either dry periods. Maybe some of those cattails would dry out, or maybe new grass plantings in the area could bring that back. But
so let's turn the corner and talk some positivity.
Yeah,
Hun numbers, if I recall correctly, last year, not this year's forecast, but last year, it was like 200+% increase in huns.
Yeah, and we were seeing 100%, you know, 100%, 200% increases. Basically, 200% is just quadrupling from the year before. So, kind of interesting. The people remember the high years of partridge being in the 80s and 90s, but our roadside counts, they peaked. That's where late summer we're driving around really slow in the mornings and the wet, dewy mornings looking for pheasants, partridge, and all upland species, but pheasants, partridge, and sharptail primarily. We're watching for chicks, and you know, on a normal route, you might see partridge every, you know, three or four routes. A route is 20 miles. And then the last 5 years, we've been ramping up and seeing similar to what they saw in the 1990s. Hmm. Last year, we tied with the highest year, which was 1992.
So really? What do you attribute that to?
We'd have no clue. people attribute it to drought. That's what the 80s population was attributed to.
That huns do well during a drought.
Yep. But, you know, you get into too far west of here where it's consistently dry in the summer, and it's not like they have record high or, I mean, abnormally high partridge numbers. Mm. So if it were just drought, I think that they'd be a lot higher consistently in Montana than they are here. I'm not sure it's just drought. I think it's probably a mix of where the cropland ends up.
Gotcha.
Yeah, combination of crops, drought, you know, really bad droughty years, people give up on fields and they'll turn into almost a fallow, weedy looking field. I mean, that for sure is good for upland birds. We know that fallow fields were really great when they were, when it was still common practice.
Right.
So I think it's a little bit of that. And I think just the perfect June weather for them, I think that really, really matters. If you get good Junes consistently 2 or 3 years in a row. Mm. And ultimately, number-wise, I know what we attribute it to is that we had, you know, 10 chicks per brood for the average brood size. I think that was 4 years in a row, for sure four, maybe even 5 years in a row that we had over 10 chicks per brood. And this year, our scale's not that wide, so in a bad year, we might have 7 or 8. So this year, we're 8-point-something chicks per brood.
Mm.
It's not that wide of a scale, but the fact that we had that peak of that scale, you know, 10 or 11 for 4 or 5 years in a row really helped.
Can you talk a little bit more about huns specifically? I think that they're just such a charismatic little bird, and I especially like that they raise their broods as a pair. I just think that's kind of cute.
So romantic.
Yeah. Mom and dad. Yeah. But I don't know. I get a lot of questions from people who have never seen huns, just about them and kind of what their life cycle looks like, how to hunt them, what to target. So I don't know. Give us some hun information.
Yeah. So first of all, if anybody hasn't hunted them, but they've hunted quail, I mean, just think of them as quail because they behave really similar to bobwhite. You're looking for edges. They're basically surviving here because we have small grains. So, you know, if you're not around wheat or barley or one of the small grain crops, you're probably not going to see too many partridge. We kicked them out of a cornfield this morning. I always tell people it's not where I normally look for them, so it was a little odd that they flushed out of there, but corn's probably a little bit larger grain than what they prefer. But yeah, look for edges, old farm machinery, anything that's sitting out in a field that has grass growing around it. A lot of times the old farmsteads, of course most of those are posted nowadays, but that's where you usually see a covey of partridge, and they're pretty localized, so they don't have huge home ranges. Like you said, the pairs pair up, they have a small home range, and then once they have their coveys stay together. Like all birds, they will merge with other coveys, but they're not, you know, pheasants by the fall, their coveys are merging and mixing, and you know, those chicks aren't necessarily with the hen that hatched them out. Whereas with partridge, it seems like it's pretty consistent that those coveys will stay together even late into winter, so all the way till the next year when they start splitting up into pairs again and getting more isolated.
So my perception is that North Dakota probably harvests the second most number of huns in the country behind Montana. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would venture to say it would even be more than Montana most years. I'd say Montana recently has probably taken the lead.
Okay.
And yeah, I guess the reason I'm not sure if I've ever seen Montana's harvest numbers, but one of the reasons I think North Dakota would have more is just because there's so many more upland hunters in North Dakota
what about
South Dakota.
What about Sharpies? Where does North Dakota stand in terms of harvest number of Sharpies compared to other states?
We say we're number one or two, but yeah, it's probably similar. I don't know if we have really good numbers to compare Montana or South Dakota and North Dakota, but...
all those
sure,
blue platers coming over here boosting your numbers. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. No, and for sure the Western, you know, if we could have a West Dakota, East Dakota, it would be West Dakota that would have all the Sharpie harvest. So that's by far the majority of it. Into northeastern Montana.
I've read on the Game and Fish website that North Dakota is home to a third of the world's sharp-tailed grouse population. And... That has impacted me so profoundly, just the weight of the responsibility, I guess, of knowing that we have a third of the world's sharp-tailed grouse population. Kind of terrified me a little bit.
Yeah, and I
just knowing what's at stake.
Don't want to burst the bubble too much, but I guess I wouldn't put too much stock in that. I think some of those numbers, I think other states would probably say, you know, with most things, it says we're number one. Everybody wants to be number one. I think that probably came from some competitive looking at the ways of looking at the numbers. I'm not sure that includes, you know, all the populations up into Canada and stuff like that. So, but it is, I mean, by far and away, we're, you know, probably have the most sharp tail in the continental U.S. And yeah, might be shifting into Montana as we're losing grass in eastern North Dakota. We used to have sharp tail all the way to Fargo, and now there's a lot of areas where it probably would be hard to find.
Do you hear
background
that?
Music for
Hopefully
us.
Hopefully you can hear that coming through. There's a rooster literally cackling at us in the city limits or close to
Somebody's
it.
Dog got out and flushed a bird while we're sitting.
Well, that's a good transition. Let me thank Onyx Hunt, another national sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and a partner of On the Wing podcast. If you are listening to this right now and you're hearing my voice, go to the link in the show preview text, and that'll take you to onyxhunt.com. You can use the code PFQF and get 20% off your subscription to Onyx, and Onyx Hunt will make a donation back to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission thanks to Onyx. Onyx supports darn near everything we do, particularly when it comes to public access. And that's where I want to transition to now. In the last episode, we talked about plots, public lands open to sportsmen. In the state of North Dakota, those acres total up to 836,000 total acres of open access in the state. And that's where we started this morning. I'll throw it to Emily to tell us about our first starting point, because we retooled even before sunrise.
Yeah, we got to our first spot and then decided to pivot a little bit. That rooster in the background has a lot to say.
Yeah, it's getting louder.
Yeah. So got to our first spot and it just maybe wasn't exactly what we were hoping for. So turned our 12 car caravan around and not quite that big, but
sometimes it feels like it.
Yeah. decided to start on a piece of plots ground instead. Jesse and I thought that it looked like a good place to start out, a little warm up walk. We parked the first couple trucks and a sharp tail got up right from the edge. So we took that as a good sign. Takes the group a little while to get things ready and to get rolling out in the field, but we eventually made it.
Did you see the smirk there, Andrew?
I've never claimed to be fast personally, and I've never claimed this group is fast together. In fact, I told Jesse, like, we're not doing anything quick, but once the engine's running, we're like a diesel. Then we just keep on going.
And for anybody who's seen the diesel, I was going to point that out when you said 12-car caravan. Probably does look like 12 cars when people see that when they're out harvesting, but just so they know that we only have five hunters, I think if they knew that, they wouldn't be quite as intimidated as seeing five big vehicles blowing by.
Five vehicles with a hunter in each and a camera guy in each.
So we saw quite a few sharptail on our first walk. It was relatively short cover, so not exactly what you would look for a bunch of pheasants. But the sharptail seemed to be pretty happy with it. We didn't get anywhere close to shooting range. The one from the truck was the closest one we saw the whole walk, but that's all right. Actually, where we ended up flushing those birds from, Jesse pointed out that it looked like a lekking area. So that was neat to be able to see that and to chat with him a little bit about sharptail behavior and their leks and just all the kind of information that he just picking his brain about sharptail and their behavior. And I don't know if Jesse, you want to talk a little bit about, like, if someone doesn't know what a sharptail lek is or what kind of behavior they're displaying in the spring, how significant that particular spot is, you know, just maybe expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, that was definitely cool to find another thing that I'm, you know, one of those resume builder things that for my position are doing surveys in the spring, and sharptail surveys are 100% based on those leks. Those leks are dancing grounds that they return to year after year. Males are very faithful to leks. After about a year of age, they'll go back to their same spots. Some studies even have looked at how big of an area they'll defend within that dancing ground, and we're talking, you know, square meters, so really small areas. It's not like a quarter section of land. But those leks are small, localized points. You know, 15 birds will be in an area 30 yards across competing for those territories, and the males that are the most dominant, when the hens come to get bred, they'll show up on that lek. They'll wander around the outskirts, and if anybody's ever seen a duck or a chicken, they all kind of do the same thing. When they whatever they're looking for, they identify that male, and they'll be submissive to that male. So they'll squat down in front of them and let that male breed them about 3 seconds, and they're done, and the hens will take off, and the males will go back to fighting. So so the area that we saw today, we could hear it long before we got there. Those males,
could hear it basically two rises before we got there.
Yeah, quarter mile or over a quarter mile. In the spring when we're doing surveys, we stop every half mile, and it's pretty common to hear them, you know, a mile or so away on a calm morning. So, and we picked that out, walked over there, and saw those birds flush. Unfortunately, like you said, too far away. But still cool to get to see that.
The day
length is similar to what it is in April when they're breeding. So that's why they're pretty active this morning, but they will return to those leks all season long.
It's interesting because, you know, so I've seen sharptails dancing on a lek, and it sounds dramatically different to my ears than what I heard today. Is that true, or is my memory wrong?
Part of it might have been memory. If we were closer, I think we would have heard noises that we weren't hearing from a distance.
Okay.
That hooting sound, I don't know. We heard mostly they were just kind of doing that garbling sound.
It was kind of like a chatter.
Yeah. But every once in a while they do that hoot that sounds a lot like a great horned owl. They do a lot more of that in the spring, and then they do a lot more of the foot stamping in the spring when they're closer to business, I guess. But
of the different grouse displays that you've seen, do you have a favorite species to watch?
I'm a sharptail guy, so I love sharptail. I grew up, that was closest to home for me to see sharptail. I remember our family, my parents built a house when I was in high school or junior high, and we had sharptail. We were on the edge of town, so we still had sharptail close enough to where they'd fly in and land on the porch in the winter and look out the window and see one of those at 6 or 7 feet away out the window.
Oh,
is pretty cool. But you know, so I love sharptail, but I do say, maybe because I don't hear it as often, but that prairie chicken booming sound is just awesome when you get close to them and hear that sound. It seems like it should be the sound of the, for sure, of the tall grass prairies, but it's just such a unique sound. But.
And sage grouse sound sort of alien
to
me. I mean, they're almost not like a bird makes that noise.
Yep, yeah. And sage grouse sound doesn't carry very far, so you have to be pretty close. Oh, and usually you can see them by the time you hear that, so it's pretty... I mean, just the sheer size of those birds is striking. You know, big black and white bird on the prairie in the spring looks pretty remarkable. But
it's interesting that their sound doesn't carry as far, being that they're so much bigger.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. They just. I think that hooting sound carries the furthest for both prairie chicken and sharptail. Mm. Those low, you know, constant sounds, but then that garbling from the sharptail is the other one. You can hear that from a long way in the spring.
So. We flush 18 sharptails, confirmed by the math savant, counting and doesn't throw up on helicopters. And then we go back to the trucks. I guess we had flushed one rooster out of there. Or Aaron, our videographer, flushed a bird out of range for the rest of us. And then you guys kind of put your heads together and decided where to go next. Tell us about that conversation.
Yeah, Andrew told me to follow my heart. To pick a spot.
And, that's how I get out of making decisions on this trip.
Unfortunately, my heart misled me because we got to a plots piece and it looked, there were parts of it that looked good. But as I parked the truck and got out to kind of check in with everyone, we could hear some gunshots coming from one end of it. And then we decided to turn around and try a different spot. And as we were turning around, realized that there was a car parked on the other end of it. So I don't know if there were two separate parties or the same person. But either way, we decided to move on and find a different spot. And I'm glad that we made the move because the next spot, for Bob anyway, was a pretty productive walk.
Well, when we rolled up to it, you had an...
Oh, my pupils were dilated when we rolled up to
you
it.
You had a perma smile.
Yeah.
You got out of your truck and you're like... Oh, yeah. I feel at home now.
What? I was like, everyone get their guns right now. We have work to do. Well,
so, and Jesse had a similar perspective. Explain what you saw that made you so happy.
maybe you should back up a little bit and explain what we saw in Onyx first, why you went to that one that your heart led to. Because I think that one, I thought the same thing. I thought that looked like a slam dunk when we left our first area, so...
Yeah, so we could see that it looked like there was some grassland on this other plots piece that was bordered by some cropland. Looked like some deep draws with a little bit of brushy cover, creek running through at least part of it. So I was really hoping for some thicker pheasant cover that we could get down in and produce some birds. And we very well... could have had that if we had hiked back into it, but so then we were looking at the map trying to find another spot, and with having a group the size that we have and just, you know, all the dogs and camera people and everything, we have to be conscious of that to make sure that there's a bigger enough spot for all of us to feel comfortable and have safe shooting opportunities and not be too crowded. So we found a plots piece that had a creek running through it with some good cover on either side, and we could tell there was a crop field there. Of course, we couldn't tell what it was. We get there and it's a cut cornfield, which is great news. So it was great that it was cut because that kind of keeps those birds in the cover where they're a little bit easier to have shooting opportunities on when you're making contacts with them versus when the corn is still standing, they're going to get in that corn and run, and you might see them flush out the end of the field, you know, several hundred yards away, but you're not getting very good shooting opportunities on them most of the time. So it was exciting, and it proved to be fruitful. But yeah, just really looking for that kind of edge of field cover. Having a creek going through it, I think, really helps with how effectively you're able to hunt it, because it serves as like a natural kind of pinch point almost, where when those birds get to the edge of the creek, they're likely going to flush. And so, you know, with us walking up on kind of the tops of that creek and the dogs going down into it, that just helped us maximize on shooting opportunities.
You used one word that when I asked you, what do you like about this? And the word was edge. Like, that's the first thing you said, that with that creek in there, it created a tremendous amount of edge, didn't it?
Yeah, several types of edges too. And that's, you know, I was just thinking about what I didn't like about that second place we stopped at. One, we were driving through and trying to get cattle off the road in front of us. Mm-hmm. This year, because it's so dry, you know, seeing a lot of cattle in an area, the grass was pretty short. So with a group, you know, there were some draws. If I was alone, I would have got out and walked that. But with a group, yep. It's like there just wasn't enough cover there. Another thing is that one, you know, it looked like it was a lot more stagnant grass. So that grass had probably been grazed year after year for the last 20 years. This second place that was really good compared to that had, probably 4 or 5 year old grass plantings. So it was a lot more open understory. It wasn't so, it wasn't just solid grass, solid smooth brome grass. It was a mix of grasses. There's a lot of that evening primrose and different thistles and stuff in there, probably for better or worse, but just the mix of some of that stuff really helped, make it look like a good spot for pheasants. But and then the draws too, both of them had a creek through them, but the difference was the one creek, you know, the second one was 4 or 5 feet wide at the wide spots versus that other one was probably more of a, I think that was part of the Heart River. But that area, the banks were probably 60 feet high. So You're looking at pretty steep hills and tight, draws. Whereas the second place, the cliffs were probably out 12 feet at the most.
Yeah.
So, those hillsides were big enough to provide some shrubs and some different edge going from the grass to shrubs back to grass. But then not so big that they felt more like a whitetail or turkey draw. So, yeah, kind of tough to key in on all those things. You definitely can't tell the difference from an aerial photo, so that's why it does take some driving around and troubleshooting and figure out which one's going to be the good one to walk. But
so we dove in as a group and tried to hunt along the edge of that creek, and that took some getting used to. Andrew had to course correct me twice.
I was just putting you where the birds were eventually going to be. You're welcome.
That's true. Just true. So,
can you do that for me next?
Well, now that you ask, yeah, absolutely.
And it took us a little while. I mean, we flushed a couple hens. It wasn't until we got like on the backside of that creek, which was maybe an hour in, that we started to get some action. And that's when Gitch went on point. Ever so briefly, but she was on point, and it was enough time for me to flag Aaron and flag you, and a rooster got off that point, and you and I shot in tandem, and it's anybody's guess. We'll go back to the tape to see who actually hit it. The wing on the left side was broken, so we'll see who shot to the left, but we had our first bird in the bag in the second spot. And it took us a little while because it is dry and it wasn't crushed. That bird hit the ground and did a double take, and it wasn't where we thought it was going to be. It took a few minutes for the dogs to find him.
Yeah, it came back toward us, actually. Mm-hmm. I had my eye on where – I don't hunt with dogs all the time, so I always keep my eye right where they go down and thought, we got to find that where that went down. And I was walking there, and the dogs were coming toward me, and I was going to just push past them, and I thought, they got better noses than I do, and I let them work, and sure as heck, they came up with that bird, a couple feet in front of me, 20 feet short of where I was heading to. So,
I do think that's one of the bigger challenges, and Emily, what I'm thinking about is just how dry it's been and the challenge for dogs to find down birds and to get scent, and now you've had a little bit of rain, so it's a little better, but that's it's dry out there. Bring your water and be prepared to hunt early when you might have a better chance of getting scenting conditions.
The dry cover also doesn't help with getting birds to hold, because mm-hmm. we're pretty loud crashing through that.
Yeah. And we weren't the first people in there. I don't know if it was today, but there were definitely hunters that have been hunting that, so that's a tough part when you find really good looking stuff. Several people in a group say this looks awesome, mm-hmm. obviously it's going to draw eyes from other people.
True.
Too, so
especially when it's right off the blacktop.
The good part for all the North Dakota hunters who don't like drawing attention to this stuff is that, compared to other places, we still have pretty sparse hunting populations. And then we have a you know, late fall harvest for corn, sunflowers, and some of the crops where these birds are hanging out. So we were talking this morning, there's kind of a slow release. All those birds that are in the crops right now will be coming out every time a field is harvested. So even though opener, you know, saw thousands of people out in the field, we'll have fresh birds coming out of the crops as they get harvested.
Yeah, a lot of times when I drop an onyx pin, it'll say, when I do think to label it, and I often don't, but I'll pin it as hunt after crops are harvested, because yeah. I know that, you know, I'm whether or not I walk it that day after those crops are harvested, it's going to be prime time.
So we pick up that bird, and we get to the field boundary, the property boundary, and then we drop down to the creek level, and there's, how do you best describe it? It wasn't an island because it wasn't surrounded by water, but it was an island in terms of it was a lower bowl of grassy habitat at creek level where we had just gotten a bird up above 12 feet. And I'd say 50% of the birds we saw on that property, roughly, were in that bowl. Any theories, Jesse, as to why the birds were in that bowl? Were they just pressured there over the course of the weekend? Was there something that you saw that they liked it there? What do you think?
It could have been somewhat due to pressure. I mean, it's on the far side of the plots from the road. I would have assumed that time when we started walking, I think I told you, my guess was that a lot of birds were out in the fields feeding. And it was later by the time we got over there, so I don't know if they were, you know, could have been even in that first bit of cornfield there and pushed across from us. Either that or right after they fed, that was just the closest stuff away from the road that they went into to roost for the afternoon. But yeah, it was pretty similar cover to a lot of that stuff that we walked the whole way.
Right.
A little more open on the ground, especially that first one that flushed out. It was, you know, the dogs were getting birdie and it looked good because the ground is pretty open there. There's a lot of sign in the ground there, so that seemed like a little better area for birds just to navigate. But yeah, I'm not sure what else. I do notice on bends of creeks a lot of times where you got that hill. I don't know if that's where those birds go or if they'd been running ahead of us that whole time and that's just where they finally got pinched where they had to flush. But it does seem like on those bends of creeks they get up.
You're nodding your head uncontrollably in the affirmative, Emily.
Yeah, well, I agree with that assessment, definitely. There were, and similar to, like, what I was saying with that, the creek serving as kind of a natural, I don't know if pinch point's the right word, but a natural spot where those birds are going to stop running and are more likely to flush. There were a couple times where I wanted to push you over closer to the edge of the creek.
Okay.
Yeah, just because...
it's harder.
You're just kind of
up
in your chances of better habitat.
They're there.
Of getting a shooting opportunity there. Because the other thing that happens is that cover's really good, and they bury themselves into it, and then you can walk right past them. And we watched you guys do that actually, where a bird got up behind you as you were walking along the creek, and it backdoored you.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Did I know it?
No.
I don't think I even.
No, you didn't even flinch.
Huh?
No. It was a young bird. But...
Was it a rooster?
I don't think so. I think it was a young hen.
It was a hen, yeah.
Huh. Oh, yeah, we heard that one, I'm pretty sure.
You could tell by the sound it wasn't. Exactly.
Do you remember, Jesse, what you asked me when we got out of the truck and we looked and saw the river?
Just about how we were going to hunt it or how we were going to cross?
Oh, you asked about your dog. Yeah, you remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
So we got out of the truck and Jesse's like, will your dogs cross the creek to get to retrieve a bird? And I was like, yes, if they see it, particularly Gitchy, she'll no problem. And then I was like, I wonder if there's foreshadowing there, which takes us to the next bird because Rooster got out of that bowl, flushed right to left, and I absolutely whiffed the first shot, which would have dropped it on our side of the river. And but thankfully, I got it on the second shot, and Gitchy was on that bird. I think you could see it, Andrew, better than I could.
Yeah,
I
we could both see it from up on top of that hill, and it was beautiful. It was so fun to watch that. Yeah,
it was fun for me, but I didn't think I saw it as well.
That shot that you made, that was a poke. That bird was out there. Yeah, Yeah.
Yeah, we were sitting in the cheap seats, just watching the game below.
I knew I better make one of those two shots because I missed the first one.
I was surprised you missed the first one, and I was surprised you hit the second one.
Mm-hmm. Double whammy.
That's how I would, like, that second one was like a, ooh.
And I dropped it stone dead, too.
Yeah.
Well, it was great because I got to watch it crash outside of your purview and like just land in the water slash right where that far bank hit.
Oh, it was in the water?
It was in the water.
Oh.
So was it Gitch?
Gitch.
So, yep. So Gitch had to go over the peninsula in the water, cross the creek, and grab it at the base
and
of the creek
in
the
water.
There's
no way she would have saw that all.
No. Like, it was still, it was like flapping a little bit.
Oh.
So she, it was like a hunt test, basically. Like, she did all the obstacles, went, found the bird, and made a straight line back to you. It was super fun to watch.
She passed.
Yeah, I was very pleased with her.
I was so glad that we were up on that hill where we could watch that all unfold, because that was just picture perfect.
I'm
so
just
fun.
So glad I made that shot.
We are too.
Yeah, I know.
We only had one in the bag at that point. It's like, we could use that bird.
So after that retrieve, then we ended up getting split up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse, Emily, Aaron, and me, we ended up on one side of the creek. So, Andrew, you were with a group that had a little more action.
I mean, we had some action. So I'm not a professional animal counter, but, like, I would assume that.
How's your nausea in helicopters?
I would guess 12 pheasants got out of that boil that you're kind of talking about, like when we were, like, from beginning to end, because they all didn't just get up at once.
Right.
Like, they started kind of like piling out ahead of us too.
Yeah.
I saw where a few of them ended up. I knew some of them were roosters, and we were on the far east edge heading north, and I was with Logan and Nate, and I knew we would touch that corner post of the plots that we were on. Is 160 acres, butted up against another 320. But we primarily stayed on that one core square, and then we were going to work dead west. And so I knew we would hit those birds again, and we did. So we kind of made our little right angle left, if you will, and I looked at Logan. I'm like, you know they're going to start boiling out of here too. And a couple got up wild, and then suddenly one got up in front of Nate. He hit it. It sailed out in front of them, but then hooked back left. It wasn't like, let's just say that bird may have been running for sure. But we kept on walking forward to meet up with that bird, and then another one got up. Both Logan and I shot at the same time. I feel pretty good about my shot. I guess we'll have to go to instant replay again to see whose bird it was, but I'm guessing we both tagged it. But we were able to get that bird, and then we immediately went to the fence line, and this is where I forgot that 320 was plots. So we all stopped at that fence line and let the dogs go and try the bird, go try and find the bird that Nate dropped, because it was right on the other edge. And so as the dogs are rooting around there looking for that drop bird, another giant rooster, the biggest rooster I've ever seen. That was just how it feels in that moment, gets up, and Nate pulls up on it, and I start yelling, private, 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 like, we can't, like, you can't shoot that bird. We could have shot that bird. So, like, that was just me being, like, overly, like, safe and also thinking that was, like, private on the other end. I didn't know if it was posted or not. And then Emily, when we're walking back, was like, I'm pretty sure that plots too. Like, where were you? I was like, that could have been
the confidence with which he said, that's private, as I was looking at my map going, I think that has red dots on it. I think that's also plots.
It throws you for a loop because, like, with plots, it could be a completely harvested egg field. It could be grass. So, like, when you're walking up against a completely harvested egg field, it just feels awfully private. Mm-hmm. Like, and I guess that's just, like, from where I'm from. It's like, that's someone's ground, and chances are it's not, like, hunting ground. Like, why would it be enrolled in this program? Like, that's just an out-of-stater just not thinking clearly is honestly what that is. We didn't end up finding that bird that Nate dropped. So out of the two roosters we hit, we brought back one.
Yeah.
So that brought the total to three for the day.
We're at three, but we're not done.
No, we got to get going.
We got to get going. I'm looking at the clock. It's 3:00. So we'll learn. Emily will tell us a little bit about where we're going next in a moment, or give us a potential game plan. Before we talk about where we're going next. A shout out to Grain Belt Premium and Premium Light, the pheasant friendly beer, now sporting the Pheasants Forever logo on camo cases, cans, and bottles. Good land, good beer, and today's premium moment comes via Instagram from Sean Taylor. And here is Sean's premium moment in the field. For a few years now, my buddy Josh and I have had an annual pheasant hunt that we look forward to like kids before Christmas. This year was extra special. Josh had just bought a brand new over and under shotgun, and we were eager to put it to the test. His Black Lab Pierce was in high spirits too, as the backbone of our operation. As soon as we hit the field, Pierce was on his A game. He flushed the first rooster, Josh missed with his new shotgun, and I knocked it down with my shot, and Pierce retrieved it to me. You could tell Josh was a little disappointed missing the first bird with his brand new shotgun. Then it happened again. Another bird, another miss from Josh. And you know what? I dropped that bird too. The tension was now rising. I was practically, I was practically supporting the shotgun shell industry with my usual misses, but not today. I was somehow on target while Josh, the deadeye, was struggling. Pierce, as usual, was flawless, bringing bird after bird back to us. Finally, Josh had his moment. Kind of. A bird got up, Josh fired. Bird faltered, didn't quite fall, but Pierce, the Black Lab, saved the day and brought that crippled bird back to Josh's hand. It was a rough day with a brand new shotgun, but all in all, we had a great time. As the day wound down, Josh suggested we line up the birds for a picture with a perfect orange sunset behind us. He laid them out, guns down, and Josh took a minute to admire his only bird of the day, still laughing about all his misses. He reached into his pocket for his phone, and that's when it happened. The pheasant, his pride and joy, sat up, hopped off his vest as he was taking a photo with his phone, and flew off into the sunset. Josh just stood there staring at it as the bird flew away, and while I was laughing so hard I couldn't hardly contain myself. After a long pause, Josh just shook his head and said, "I need a beer." Cheers to the ones that got away and the memories that stick around forever. Sean, that was a very fun story. Josh, sorry about your bird, buddy. Thanks to Grain Belt Premium and to Josh on Instagram for bringing us that premium moment in the field. We've got a Grain Belt Premium prize pack headed your way. Have you ever had a bird fly off, Andrew, after you had it in a vest?
I haven't, no.
Emily's shaking.
I had one, yeah. Really? 2 seasons ago, I had some friends out from back home from Michigan, and we were one bird short of our limit for the morning hunt. Went into town for lunch, ate lunch, came out, and from the truck bed, a rooster got up and took off and became a resident of Regent, North Dakota. So then we were two birds short of our limit.
Wow. Ever happened to you?
No, not with birds. No. I've had cottontails when I was a kid do that to me. And
really?
Yeah, heard stories of others, but yeah.
Andrew, tell us our membership promotion for Rooster Road Trip listeners.
Yeah, everybody go to roosterroadtrip.org. If you sign up and become a member or renew your membership, we'll give you a Browning Bird and Buck knife set. That's right, set. Two knives. Why do I need two knives and one sheath? Well, let me tell you. Last night, not only did I clean birds with one, I then ate the birds with the other. I mean, how much better does it get than that? I mean, it's the perfect set. Go see for yourself. But here's the good news on top of the good news. Anybody who signs up through that offer will be automatically entered to win a Browning Satori 825, the newest of the new. It's brand new, ladies and gentlemen. You should actually look into it. It's a sweet gun. I've been carrying it around all week. I know I won't have one after this trip, and that already makes me sad. So that's a hint to my wife that we might need to have a conversation when I get home. But anyways, you could win one. Go join or renew your membership at roosterroadtrip.org.
And thank you to our Rooster Road Trip partners, Browning Firearms, Federal Ammunition, Orvis Hunting Apparel and Dog Products, Ruffling Kennels, Garmin, Irish Setter Boots, Sound Gear Hearing Protection, and Yeti Coolers. All right, Emily, what are we going to do next to close out?
You are putting her on the spot. My goodness.
I know.
What did you say? Follow your heart. Tell us what your heart says. What are we going to do?
Well, practical experience so far based on this trip has told me that we need a plan A and a B and a C and a D. So we've got a few plots pieces lined up to check out. So we'll see if there's any other hunters out there, which one we end up settling on, and based on, you know, what the habitat looks like when we get there. So we've got our first plan ready, and we'll see where we need to pivot to from there.
Jesse, what are you looking for in a golden hour spot? When we roll up, what's going to put a perma smile on your face?
Yeah, same as our second spot today.
edge.
Seeing all that edge, and like I said, I call it structure, but just looking for differences, you know. Nothing flat stuff looks kind of boring to me, although I've shot birds out of flat, smooth brome fields before, but so usually something with a bunch of different vegetation, different parts of their habitat, from roosting to food. The evening right before sunset, a lot of times they'll come out and eat again, and then pick gravel. So look for those things. That's where you usually see birds right before sunset. So they're going to be close to there.
Well, it is a beautiful afternoon turning into evening here shortly. So listen to episode 3 of Rooster Road Trip to find out if our search for edge and Emily's following her heart turn into birds to close out the second day of Rooster Road Trip. Thanks all for following along. I'm Bob St. Pierre for Jesse Kohler, Andrew Vavra, Emily Spolier. Thanking you for listening and reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.